So we have some time now for any questions or any observations that you have from today. Anything that might not have been clear in what we shared, or anything you might have, any experiences that you've had, anything that you'd like to share, anyone will take some time to do that now. So if you have a question or comment, please raise your hand, arm. So can I just clarify that last part? So you're asking about, may I be safe? And is it the kind of implication that being safe isn't accepting impermanence? I see. Okay. No, it's a great question. Do you want me to have a start on that?
Sure.
Or do you want to start on that?
You go ahead.
I think it's a really, really good question, really important question. In terms of the first part, not accepting impermanence, I would encourage you to just, first of all, just bring awareness to, there's a quality right now of non-acceptance, And so can you be accepting of the non-acceptance, Can you bring a kind, interested awareness to, oh, there's some resistance here. Notice how you're feeling it, where you're feeling it, And notice the thoughts that are coming up in your mind, Like, is it a questioning about the concept or the idea of impermanence? Is it like wanting to hold on to something that feels more permanent? I would encourage you just to bring a kind of a spirit of inquiry and interest and kindness to your experience. And it's a great place. It's natural for us not to want to accept impermanence. It's natural for us to want to hold on to things, to create safety and a real kind of bedrock kind of safety. Okay, I've got this. I've got $20 million, that should keep me, I'll be okay now. Well, maybe it's not, maybe I need 20 billion, kind of that sense of safety. And so just really, I think, first of all, inquiring into, is there something I'm holding on to here? Is there something I'm resisting here? And just kind of let that in, see how it is to kind of, how would I be if I were to just sit back and rest in the impermanence? And then you might notice there's like, no, I want it to be, okay, just invite it again. So just make that a place, I think, of inquiry and see if you can bring acceptance to that quality of, in a sense, of, in immediate sense, of non-acceptance. And just a short word about the kind of what might be an implicit contradiction between the kind of the truth of impermanence and yet we're wanting safety. The way I see it is, we're not looking for a kind of safety that contradicts impermanence. We're not kind of saying, okay, I want to live forever. That's the kind of safety I want. I want so much, so many resources that nothing can go wrong or something. That would be delusional, because, good luck, as it's not going to happen that way. So what are we looking for? What are we inviting or intending for ourselves and for others when we say, may I be safe and may you be safe? I think what we're intending is the safety that allows us to kind of be in the world. And, without some sense of safety, we're just going to be completely in that fight or flight mode. We're going to be in that defended mode. And we're not going to be willing to accept, what is unfolding. So we need, some level of safety that is wholesome. It's not this is going to last forever, but it's a sense of, I don't have to fear right now that, something's going to kind of drop down on my head, or that these people are not going to attack me, some kind of thing that might be in our minds, mm-hmm. but more just a sense of, the space that I can actually be here now. I can open to my experience. So having that sense of, you know, kind of relative sense of safety then allows us to open and really experience impermanence as the deeper kind of bedrock of our experience. So those are a couple of things I'd share.
Yeah, and just a couple of things. Impermanence, I mean, I would play with whether I actually think I could actually hold on with something, just to see if it, you know, because it, you really can't, you know, it's always fleeting, right? And I heard Joseph Goldstein say once that this is all kind of related to holding on and letting go, and he said something like, letting go is not letting, it is the understanding that you can't hold on to anything. And that was an interesting switch around for me. So impermanence is really an understanding that there isn't anything that's really permanent and lasting. So the idea of the practice is to understand that it's not letting go, it's understanding you really can't hold on to anything because it's impermanent. And another thing that I do with the Brahmaviharas around the statements is it makes more sense to me sometimes when I say, may I be safe in the midst of this struggle. May I be safe. May I be at ease in the midst of this argument. May I be, you know, in the midst of. So it's atmospheric. It's the air quality. It's the temperature in the room. It's the mind mood that we're trying to influence when we make these statements. It's not the hardcore, am I going to get something, but it's intending to create an atmosphere that welcomes the experience that you're having.
I wouldn't, and I'm not very articulate about this, because it's like, so we're not accepting that this is the way it is. There's Confederate flags everywhere, and they're offensive. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, should be taking, because that, and that's the thing, is you could turn the argument into, well, people will get around to taking those down when they take them down. You know, I'm kind of with the woman who went up the flagpole, right? You know, sorry, don't want to see that anymore. Thanks so much. But I don't think that's particularly Buddhist of me either. So I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is kind of, thanks to you. This is one of those, in the Buddhist teachings, we talk about the five hindrances, and the fifth one is doubt. And it just makes so much sense that we run into these places where, you know, but it's not this, it's not that. And we could literally go nuts trying to find where it all lines up and it's neat. And it just doesn't quite come together that way. And all of these things that you're describing are moments in time, and they're changing all the time. And the truth of the matter is that you can bring down the flag, you can have a group of African-American families saying, I forgive you. That's still in the middle of something, not the end. So all of this is changing and dancing, and will change and dance again. And part of this practice, I feel, is like that, like the ground underneath the craziness that's going to keep on changing and swirling and not adding up. But there's a way that we want to look at how we hold it. You know, the hardest thing for me in my family, for example, is that I'm the only one that's Buddhist. You know, and they're not the apologetic type. So, it's just not across the board. It just doesn't add up. People are going to do, you know, these blooms are going to be popping everywhere. And so it's good to have doubt. I hope the doubt can invite you to investigate what your real experience is moment to moment. But Buddhist is about liberating the mind and heart. And it's not about necessarily changing the world. Hopefully the world will change. But I don't think the teachings is about going out and making sure the world gets its act together. Be great. But I think if there's a critical mass of people that can do that, it's going to create a certain momentum. And maybe in a few lifetimes when we come back as another bodhisattva, we might see some things differently. But I don't think it's about whether we see the evidence necessarily. It's about how we're holding the experiences that we're having, and collectively if some good seeds can be planted. So that's just how I'm sitting with that. Does that sound
I love what you shared, and I'm just going to kind of put a tweak of mine, which I'm going to answer a question which may not be your question, but it would have been a good question. Well, you know. It's an important question. I think it was implicit in what you're saying, which is the sense that that when we talk about acceptance in the kind of this Buddhist sense, that it can have that, can seem to have that undercurrent of passivity and non-responding to what needs to be responded to. And the way I see that, and it sounds like that is at least part of your question, or important part of your question, the way I see that is when we're talking about acceptance, we're not talking about, you know, I accept that racism is necessary and, you know, whatever. We're not saying acceptance in that sense. What we're really saying is we're accepting the truth of what is, and we're starting from that place. You know, so, you know, if there's a terrible situation in front of us, we say, look, this massacre or this war or this injustice, and we say, what about that are we accepting? What we're accepting, I believe, is the truth that this is. Painful and difficult and horrendous as this is. And I think that's really what we talk about when we're talking about taking refuge in the Dharma. It's really kind of not saying, because I think this shouldn't happen, it's not happening. Or somehow we're denying the truth of it. What we're really saying is, this is, and often we are saying, this is really painful, this is really difficult, and it is the truth of how. Like racism is, what I was saying, I think, in the talk was, this is true and this is painful. There may be kind of different, somewhat nuances in terms of how we see it, but if we really look, we're saying this is true. This history, this really did happen, and it's painful, and that this history is still with us today. And how do we sit, first of all, with the truth that that is the case? This is, you know, this is really what has happened and what is happening. And then the next question, I think, is, and resting, sitting in the midst of that, what is a wise response? What is an appropriate response? There's a nice little story, a Zen story, of a teacher who'd been teaching for 50 or 60 years and was moving towards his death. The student said to him, what is the essence of all of your teaching? And the teacher said, an appropriate response, an appropriate response. That the whole, everything really rests on what is an appropriate response. An appropriate response has to start from the truth of what is. You know, painful, difficult, this is true. And so what is an appropriate response? So with what I shared around, you know, some of the elements around racial injustice, I put an interpretation or some view of things that are happening, and then inviting for myself and for all of us, how is it, what is an appropriate response? What is a wise and a compassionate response to this painful situation? And that's really the inquiry for us. So I don't think there's really any sense, although it can sometimes come across as this, I don't think there's a sense of saying yes to injustice. We're saying yes to the truth that this is the case, but we're not saying yes in a should sense, you know, this should be the case. So that's how I would, you know, that's how I look at it. And some teachers and some teachings have a little bit more of a kind of, well, this is how the world is and how it will unfold. I agree that that's the case, and I think there's the question for each of us, what is wise, what is skillful, what is compassionate, what is appropriate in terms of our response. So that's going to be what I would share. I don't know, does that...
That sounds good.
You vote for that?
I went to a retreat in June. It was a Buddhist retreat. And I learned... they taught a meditation practice that the nun called black and light. So the practice was to breathe in like a light of positive energy, like good, positive goodness. And then, so that's the imagery. and then to breathe out of your nose a dark smoke of all of the negative things, the pain and suffering and hurt, and let that smoke just rise into space. And I found it to be very therapeutic. The Tonglen is the exact opposite. How, I don't understand how they can both be therapeutic.
All I can say is give it a try and just see how it works. You know, I think there's a lot of paradoxes in the practice, and what I like about what the Buddha said is that this is a verified faith practice, which means that we know for ourselves. We get the teachings, we try them in our practice, we see what works, and then what's working now might not work in a week from now because things are different changes. So there's a lot of breadth and depth in the practice, and you'll probably hear another approach next week, is would be my guess. But try it on and see if this worked for you, then that's good to know. Can you answer that?
I think you've said it, and I think there are a lot of skillful means, you know, a lot of things, and the Buddha talked about, I don't know if he said 108,000 or 108 million, quite a few.
So many lists.
And as Ruth said, you know, there's a nice word in the Pali language, the first language of the Buddha's teachings, ehipasiko, see for yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, really, that we bring awareness and see, ultimately the question is, does this lead to happiness and well-being, or does it lead to suffering? And sometimes it may be difficult to see, but, and you know, that's really what we're inquiring into, you know. What does lead to genuine happiness? And that's the wonderful thing about this practice. Nobody can say, you know, I mean, obviously there's certain situations it doesn't go, not a good practice to go out and kill people. Yeah, okay. But in broad terms, we can't really say that this always works, this never works, this works for everybody. It's really, it is a see for yourself. And obviously we have the wisdom of thousands of years of wise practitioners mapping out the mind and really kind of seeing, okay, you do this and then this tends to happen. But even then, it's not an absolute thing, you know. You could do a certain practice that a lot of people, this is really wonderful, and you find that what comes up is, you know, the exact opposite of what the practice is supposed to be doing. Okay, that's great. Then hold it in a kind and non-judging awareness. The wonderful thing about the practice is that at the end of the day, that we have the capacity and we can cultivate the capacity to hold everything within this kind, loving awareness. You know, if you're confused, you know, this happened this time, that happened that time, this happens for some people, that happens for other people, just hold whatever comes in presence, in loving awareness, and you can't go wrong. Because whatever is just like, oh, okay, this has come up, this is painful. Well, okay, maybe then I'll try this a little bit. And then open to what's arising. So, you know, nothing is inherently a problem if it can be held in this non-judging, kind, gentle awareness.
Thank you. Try this side up there. How about over there?
First of all, Hugh, I want to say thank you for talking about racial injustice explicitly. I was hoping that would happen today. So I came up from... Sorry, I get emotional. Okay. So I came from Richmond, Virginia, to be here today. And as you may guess, it is a deeply racially divided city. My home sangha is small, but, you know, we exist in a city that's majority African-American, and I look around the sangha, it's 98 or 99% white. And that's not just, you know, my sangha. It's reflected in all of the regional events I've been to. My particular sangha shares a space with 11 other Buddhist groups of different denominations. It's true in all of those groups as well. And I do, you know, we don't have a teacher. We're a peer-led group, and I do have some leadership role in the group. And we've had a lot of casual conversations about racial injustice. It's very much on everyone's heart. And we're not sure how do we reach out to people of color in our community, make them feel welcome. You know, I don't want to be an evangelical Buddhist. I don't think that it should exist. It's a contradiction. So I do know that, you know, part of it is just the practice has transformed my own ability to be with the difficulties in my life and in my community and to have these conversations in my life more and more. I know that that's a piece of it. But as a leader in my Sangha, how do we as a group reach out to people of color?
I'm going to let you go first with this one.
Okay. So it's not an easy question, as you know, and it's bigger than our Sanghas. And I think we tend to get excited because we have this Dharma medicine. And when we start growing in awareness, we start seeing the constellations instead of the stars, which is what I talked about earlier today. I think... I run a retreat called Mindful of Race, and it has to do with bringing mindfulness to racial issues, and it's a retreat for mixed race folks in the Dharma, especially Sanghas, to come together and explore this issue. But one of the things I encourage before white Sanghas move too quickly into African America to invite people into our Sanghas. There's a little bit of work to be done around waking up around the white awareness piece, which could be so helpful because I think what happens sometimes and why the divide happens and why the interest in being all under one umbrella is so palpable, not only in Buddhism but in churches and in our country, is because what people of color tend to bring to the racial conversation is a conversation about a cumulative impact and group identity that has had to solidify around suffering. What white people tend to bring to the conversation is good individuals and not a conversation about a collective, lived, owned, historic experience. So when we get in a room and try to talk together, there's a clash of energy and depth of racial identity. Different weights are at play, and we get hurt. And then the separation happens, and then the papancha or the stories morph into something bigger, and the divide gets even more glaring. So the whole idea, and this is happening a lot more in Buddhism, one of the things I'm encouraging is that white people get together and do some white awareness work and own a collective identity that's historic and a lot of what Hugh was talking about. People of color need to get together and recognize that the conversation around race hasn't ended just because we're all together and that there's a lot of diversity and a lot of not seen among the diversity of people of color. So we all have work to do, different kind of work. But I think when we come too prematurely, and usually white people want to do the bridging, but they haven't brought the collective to the conversation, I think we end up, there's just a lot of suffering in that, and it's unnecessary. I mean, it's an ideal. Why can't we just all get along? But the reality is that we bring different pieces, and the puzzle has to be a bit more equanimity in the engagement in order for less harm to be done. So that's what I encourage. And I think there's a lot of good material out there for people like yourself that are really interested in this and wanting to do the right thing and have a community of people that are wanting to poke around and look. And so there's some resources that I know we've put out with the letter around Buddhists for Racial Justice. There's a great website up right now that you could take a look at that lists a lot of resources. There's a flyer out there on the retreat that I give if you're interested in knowing more about that. But those are some of the things to begin. But I think this dynamic of the individual and group clash is where a lot of pain happens. So that infrastructure needs to be strengthened on the inside. Can you top that story?
The first thing I say is, you know, if you have a chance to get Ruth to come along to your sangha or group of sanghas, I think that would be wonderful. Mm. We did a teacher training program here, Tara, Jonathan, Pat Coffey and myself, back a few years ago, and Ruth did a weekend with us with all the teachers, with 60 or so teachers, and I thought it was just an amazing experience in terms of some of the things she shared there of just like, you know, how we look at things differently and group identity, and it was really, really rich. So bringing in resources like Ruth, and there's a few other people around that can be really helpful in that way as well. The only thing I would add is a little bit from our experience here in IMCW, and it's been, you know, it's actually been probably 10 years that a few of us got together and formed a diversity committee, and it was completely well-meaning, well-intentioned people, you know, both white and people of color and gay and lesbian and straight and that kind of good mixture of people. But we really didn't know what we were getting into. You know? And it was, you know, there was a lot of suffering, there was a lot of pain, a lot of difficulty, because it's really, really hard work. I mean, it's really, you know, you think, and this, as Ruth said, particularly as white people, you think, well, if my intentions are good, you know, what could be wrong? And then there can be a great gap between intention and impact, you know, that the intentions could be great, but the impact can be like really painful. And there's a lot of learning and a lot of, you know, oh God, did I say that? Oh, did I say, you know.
Did that come out?
And one of the things, we have a good friend, La, who's in our community, who's formed the affinity sanghas, you know, people of color, LGBT sanghas. And you know, what La has shared is that, like, you know, this is a work for the lifetime or many lifetimes, you know. It's not a quick fix. It's not easy. One of the things, it really took us probably out of those 10 years, it probably took us 8 or 9 years to realize, and this was getting the message as well from people of color, I'm talking now about mainly about the white leadership, was what, you know, we've talked about, that we have to do our own work before we get to the place of kumbaya, you know, of somehow, you know, we can all sit down together. And yes, I mean, sometimes people say that, you know, but aren't, you know, isn't the whole idea of Buddhism that there's non-separation and there's not difference? But in order to get there, we have to go through the relative reality of the suffering that we're in the midst of, which includes white privilege, which includes obliviousness, it includes a lot of things that we have to work with before we have the breadth of understanding and compassion to be able to have those conversations. So I completely, you know, agree with what Ruth is saying about this being a kind of a learning to get to that place. And I think some of the most important work that we've done as a community has been the, you know, for the white teachers and practitioners, has been realizing that we need to do our own work, and that we need to do it in a space where we're not causing more suffering, you know. And so there is a really good reason for, you know, white awareness groups, white awake kind of groups, just as there's a good reason for people of color to get together in a places of safety where they don't, have to, you know, deal with, you know, the kind of unwitting ignorance that we can bring, you know, if we haven't really looked closely enough. So those are some of the things, and I think that this is, you know, some quite important things are happening within our community. And as Ruth pointed to, there's a national effort in this area, Buddhist for Racial Justice. Probably a couple of thousand people have signed on to a letter. We had a conversations at the White House in May with the folks from the Obama administration, and the two key areas that we raised there were racial justice and climate change. And so that was really, and it's really good to see that the Buddhist community is really engaging in this way. And a lot of the energy came out of our community here with Ruth and with Tara and with La and myself and some Eleanor and some other folks. And so, yeah, I mean, it's really important. Thank you for the question. And thank you for coming up and your engagement in this area.
Yeah, the question was around the killing of the lion and the care for all beings, all sentient beings, not just humans. And the, you know, should I have compassion for people that have a lot of money and they're doing a lot of things with it that are maybe not so compassionate? And that this has been heavy on his heart all week and kind of just a question of how to have this conversation with people that you care about. You know, these are those things that can weigh the heart down in a big way, and it's what I think this practice was made for, suffering. You know, these kind of ways. You know, the Buddha specialized in suffering, and this is one of those particular ones. You know, especially if you're around people that you care about and they're doing things that, you know, don't kind of rise. But, you know, the Brahmaviharas, the metta, the compassion, the sympathetic joy, the equanimity practices are practices that open us to our natural home. It's the natural home of the heart. So it's like the high noon sun, these practices, which are indiscriminate. They're not deciding, I'm going to give some of these folks some compassion and not those. So the way you want to hold compassion is in that broad sense. So in my mind, everybody deserves my compassion, even though they're doing some crazy things. So that's one way. Because the freedom around the practice is around your own heart, keeping its aeration and its flow happening, so that you can bear witness and be with the 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows that are in the world. So that's the context of, you know, that's just kind of the atmosphere of looking at compassion as a practice that's not deciding who's worthy of it or not, but it's creating an atmosphere so that you can be and bear witness with ignorance is a big part of what you're talking about. The three poisons: greed, aversion, and ignorance. And I think ignorance is the platform poison, because it's what gives birth to aversion and greed. So you're in situations of delusion and greed, and the practice is about what you do next becomes important. So you want to respond in ways that's not causing more harm. Sometimes I have arguments with people holding their hand, because that sets up a whole other way that I'm relating to them. It's a bit more intimacy, and I remind myself that what I do next matters. I have to talk about a lot of things that are difficult. And so bringing a sense of understanding your impact, understanding that words have plant seeds. You know, they are volitional. That means that we're planting karmic seeds when we respond. We're planting karmic seeds when we crunch our heart and contract with judgment and hate. You have your own forms of that happening in the judgment, you know. So that's another thing to just kind of pay attention to and soften around. And send yourself metta for the contraction you're having because the situation is difficult to bear. You know, the heart is breaking. So these are situations where you need to send metta to yourself, maybe before you look at how you respond. So that's some of what I would say to that. Anything to add,
Yeah, I just want to add one thing. Just to note as well that that anyone who causes suffering, you know, from one of the, you know, greed, hatred, or delusion, is themselves suffering. And the more that we can open our hearts to that truth, that reality, that the suffering that ultimately, you know, I think we do want to be happy, and yet we make choices. We, I mean, in the big collective way, we make choices to do things that actually lead to suffering, that lead to suffering for ourselves and lead to suffering for others. And so when somebody is doing something harmful, they're themselves suffering. And so if we can cultivate a heart that is open, that can, is open enough to hold that. And, you know, we look around us and we, you know, I'd only have to name a couple of politicians and we'd probably all kind of go into a spasm of contraction, you know, around the suffering, you know. So I won't go there. But you know, that can be a wonderful practice, you know, to, you know, choose your favorite enemy politician and kind of hold them. You know, there was an administration not so long ago where, you know, I was doing a practice with a certain vice president who shall be nameless. You know, like, yeah, this is. I see suffering, but also there's somebody who wants to be happy that is going about it in a way that I think is actually not leading to genuine happiness. Can I hold this person in my kindness, loving kindness, with friendliness? And maybe it's not so easy. Maybe we do it, you know. Maybe we don't start there. Maybe we soften our hearts with somebody who it's easier to love and feel friendliness towards. But I think, as Ruth said, you know, that is our, you know, our work really is to let everybody into our hearts, not push anybody out of our hearts. And, you know, it goes without saying it's not easy, just as it's not easy to kind of let go of our habits of clinging and aversion and delusion, but we can do it. You know, as the Buddha says, we can. Just through these practices of, with kindness, bringing awareness to our experience, being interested, cultivating these heart qualities. Thank you.
What are we going to... She's had her head up over here for a while. She said that was a simple question. She said that was simpler than anything that's been out there. So the question was, she hates her contractor. She wants to... The remodeling job didn't go so well, and it took twice as long. And she's curious about how to work with that and how to stop the, you know, the impact that it's having on other places in her life. And I have no answer for her, by the way. Other than I'm agreeing with her, of course. So, you know, I don't know. There's a lot of things I could say to this. The good news that I want to affirm, though, is that there is some looking at what's happening that's happening. And... that's always the good news. That's the mindful moment when you can even interrupt it a little bit and see that you too are being poisoned by it. That's pretty important. I would really become intimate with the poison you're experiencing. You know, so I would drop the object of my agitation and focus on the pain I'm in from the contraction of the experience of judging and hating and wishing this was otherwise. This is strong aversion. Everybody knows this place, you know, and we can get hooked into a real lockdown mode, and this is what suffering is like. So it could be a subtle little Aikido move where you just shift a little bit to give yourself some goodness, to give yourself some attention. and to soften to the degree that you can. You know, it's kind of like you witness a car accident and somebody gets hurt, and it's the shift from running after the car to taking care of the child that's been hurt. So we forget we're hurting when we're in moments like that. A friend of mine that I went on retreat recently, this is a different kind of situation, but I've been pretty saturated by this racial stuff that's going on, pretty absorbed in a way. And I was telling the teacher I had an interview with how difficult this was. And the interesting thing was it was my mind that was so obsessed and crazed, but my body was kind of relaxed, but my mind was going nuts. And one of the things she said to me is, she said, "It looks like it's constant." She said, "I know it probably feels like it's constant and nonstop, but there are moments in between the experience where it's lightness, or you might delight in a sound or a bird, or you might hear a piece of music, or the baby might laugh, or you might catch a joke somewhere. There are moments in between. There's holes in the craziness, in the contraction." And she said, sometimes you have to tease those moments out when it's that kind of heavy construction. So I would invite you to take care, turn your attention inward, and also celebrate the spaces in between the craziness of the situation and really tease it out. Really give that some light and really pause when those moments, when you notice those moments of lightness in between the chaos. Because this is all changing, and, you know, the work will eventually be done, and you might, you know, who knows, but in the meantime, to see that there's holes in it, and also to take care of caring for the contraction you're in.
Just want to say, I think everything that Ruth said, yes. One, and this is like a little bit of Ruth's Aikido, is that any time we're suffering is a signal, this is a place to wake up. Mm-hmm. This is a place that I can wake up. Now, that our mind doesn't tend to go there first. Our mind tends to go to F you or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, no, hell no, not for this. You know, I think of it as a little bit like meatloaf. I'll do anything for love, but I won't do that. It's like, so I kind of say, oh yeah, I can bring awareness to this. I bring awareness to this and compassion to this and this. Ah, but not that, not the contractor. You know, it's like there's this like, not this, we all have this like, not this, you know, this one that, no, you can't bring mindfulness to this, you know. But really the truth is that's, you know, as Ruth observed, that's really there, it's in your face, and you really are paying attention to it. You're like, oh my God, this is really painful. And that's also another way of saying, wow, this is a place for me to wake up. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean it's easy. Obviously, it's a really hard place. But it's exactly as Ruth said, it's like, can I be with this unpleasantness? Can I be with this resistance? Can I be with all my judgments? Can I be with my hatred, my aversion? And can I see the spaces where I'm not caught up in the kind of the mind that says this is should be different, that maybe, you know, there are moments of peace and well-being in there. So really, I mean, what's wonderful about these situations and people, difficult people, is they're like a spotlight. They're like a flashing light that says, look here, pay attention here. This is where you can wake up. This is where freedom is, if you can open to this. And the mind tends to say, yeah, but no, I'd do it for the easy one, but not for this one. You know, but this is where we're being invited to wake up, whatever that place is. And it may not be the place, we might practice working with easier situations, but this is where the rubber is meeting the road for you.
It's like it was an easy question, right? I mean, we started with that this was an easy question.